Hello everyone, Marco Werman here. It has not been an easy 2020 for any of us. Somehow we at The World have managed to keep cranking out a news show about how the entire planet has been challenged by and coping with this historic disease. But behind every broadcast and all the reporting and production that go into it, there's an awareness that you are also trying to do your best to keep your chins up and of those next to you through this adversity. As I record this, we need 450 more people to donate to meet our goal of 1,000 donors by the end of this year. When you make a gift of $100 or more, you will not only receive an exclusive invite to a virtual party with me and the team, I will also personally thank you on a podcast episode. Donate today to The World to support our coverage tomorrow. Right now, go to theworld.org/give. And from everybody here at The World, thank you. Today on The World, a special edition marking the start of the Arab uprisings, an historic chapter that we're still living through.
Either this is the first Arab revolution of the 21st century, or it will be brutally suppressed.
10 years ago today, a Tunisian street vendor lit himself on fire. His act of defiance inspired tens of millions to rise up.
There's only so much that any citizen is going to put up with when it comes to oppression and autocracy.
A high cost was paid to fight for freedom.
I was beaten, I got electrocuted even, but we toppled the regime, so it was totally worth it.
A decade on, a region still consumed by war, political instability, and the hope for a brighter future. That's today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Shirin Jafari. This is The World. Welcome to a special edition of the show.
It is December the 17th, a day certainly on the minds of people in Tunisia, but also many others in North Africa and the Middle East. That's because exactly 10 years ago, a single event in Tunisia triggered a series of historic revolutions across the region. A street vendor selling fruit was fed up with the system. In an inspirational act of protest, he lit himself on fire.
Soon, the Arab uprisings began in several countries that had only known one ruler. People began to rise up and demand change.
Protests spread to countries that had rarely seen anything like this. People poured into the streets, shouting words that became slogans of their hopes and dreams.
In some cases, these wars did topple dictators. In others, protests led to greater repression, civil wars, and the mass displacement of millions of people.
The uprisings from 10 years ago transformed the entire region forever and continue to impact the globe.
So today, a special hour of the show, the legacy of the Arab uprisings and the many ways they're still playing out, from politics to high tech.
Let's start at the beginning.
The town of Sidi Bouzid in central Tunisia never really made headlines. It's a quiet, forgotten part of the country, far from the capital, Tunis. That changed on December 17th, 2010. A 26-year-old fruit seller set himself on fire in front of City Hall. Just a few hours before, officials had confiscated his fruit cart, saying he didn't have a permit. It wasn't the first time that happened. Mohamed Bouazizi saw this as harassment, plain and simple. He was beyond angry and frustrated, says Leila Bouazizi, Mohamed's sister. Leila says her family was struggling at the time. Her father died of a heart attack years before. Her mom was working at a farm, making about $2 a day. Mohamed started selling fruit when he was just 7 years old, she says. Bananas, strawberries, grapes, whatever was in season. Leila says her brother had complained about mistreatment by officials before, but she never imagined he would take his own life. Shortly after Mohamed's self-immolation, protests erupted in Tunisia. The country's president, Zainal Abidin Ben Ali, visited Muhammad in the hospital, but Muhammad died 4 days later. Overnight, the unknown fruit seller became a national symbol. People held up his picture in protests. Banners went up on the city walls, calling him a martyr. The country was in upheaval. People were tired of the dictatorship, Leila says. They were tired of oppression, poverty and mismanagement. That's why they reacted so strongly.
It appears to be the end for Tunisia's president after 23 years in power.
Ben Ali, the president, was forced to leave for Saudi Arabia with his wife and children. Soon, the protests in Tunisia inspired others in the region.
There's only so much that any citizen is going to put up with when it comes to oppression and autocracy.
Lina Khatib is the director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, a policy institute in the UK. She says each country had its own unique political circumstances, and protesters had different demands. But there were some common themes.
Their socioeconomic conditions had severely deteriorated. Freedom of expression was in many places non-existent or severely curtailed. And people generally just wanted social justice and dignity.
The protests that began in Tunisia challenged Arab governments across the region and brought down leaders in Egypt, Libya and Yemen. In Syria, they led to a civil war. Leila Bouazizi, the sister of Mohamed Bouazizi, says her family has been targeted and harassed. They've been accused of taking advantage of his death, she says, to enrich themselves and to live in luxury. None of that is true, she says. Leila, her husband and her mother moved to Canada a few years after the revolution. They now live in Montreal. Leila works for a company that makes airplane parts. Her youngest sister, Samia, remains in Tunisia. She's applied to move to Canada, but her application has been rejected. Ten years on, Leila says, the pain of losing her brother has not gone away. Like the other day, she was riding on the metro and she opened up her Facebook page. Someone had posted Mohammed's picture. She started crying. If we were in Tunisia, Leila says, we would pay our respects at Mohammed's grave. But we're here, far away. One day, she says, I hope all Tunisians live in dignity. That's what my brother wished for. I'm Shirin Jafari.
The protests spread from Tunisia like a wave across North Africa and the Middle East. These were among the first major protests to happen in the age of social media. It's been described as a social network revolution.
An uprising powered by Twitter and Facebook.
An aging autocrat outorganized and outmaneuvered by kids with keyboards.
Definitely, this is the internet revolution,
where the most powerful weapon was social networking.
The Facebook revolution makes a good headline, but what role did social media really play in the Arab uprisings? Here's the world's Lydia Emanuelidou.
Activist Wael Ghonim once said, if you want to liberate a society, all you need is the internet.
I said those words back in 2011, when a Facebook page I anonymously created helped spark the Egyptian revolution.
In this TED talk he gave years later, Ghonim explained what led him to create the page. He was a Google executive at the time, and while browsing Facebook, he saw a photo of a young Egyptian businessman beaten to death by police after trying to expose police corruption. His name was Khalid Said.
I could not sleep that night, and I decided to do something. I anonymously created a Facebook page and called it We Are All Khalid Said.
The page grew quickly and became the most followed in the Arab world. Hundreds of thousands of people would gather there to crowdsource ideas and share news that the Mubarak regime wouldn't allow in traditional media. In January 2011, they watched as people in Tunisia brought down their government with massive protests.
I saw a spark of hope.
Egyptians on social media wondered, if Tunisians did it, why can't we? Ghonim used his Facebook page to call for a revolution against corruption, injustice, and dictatorship. On January 25th, Egyptians flooded the streets of Cairo and other cities demanding change. The government shut down the internet and tried to stop them, but they didn't give up. And within 18 days...
There is some significant breaking news in Egypt at this hour. President Hosni Mubarak has stepped down.
As thousands danced and celebrated in the streets, Ghonim phoned in to CNN.
This revolution started online. This revolution started on Facebook.
You're giving Facebook a lot of credit for this.
Yeah, for sure. I want to meet Mark Zuckerberg one day and thank him, actually.
As protests erupted in other countries like Libya, people in the diaspora tried to help.
We wanted to participate using social media and the internet.
From Winnipeg, Libyan-Canadian Ayat Menena created the page Shabab Libya, or Libyan Youth Movement. She'd gather information from a network of sources on the ground in Libya and then put out updates on the social media feeds. There were challenges from the very beginning.
We constantly had to block people. There was a lot of pro-regime propaganda that was following us everywhere.
One night, they suddenly got thousands of new followers from Serbia.
They were all pro-Gaddafi, and they flooded all of our comments, and they posted so many pro-regime things, and they kind of attacked all of our information.
Menena enlisted volunteers. They blocked people who spammed their pages. But fake accounts kept popping up and gaining huge followings.
They would kind of stoke the fire and say things that they knew that would get people on different sides of the conflict really riled up.
What she's describing might not seem that surprising today. Governments and regimes all over the world have weaponized social media to launch coordinated propaganda and harassment campaigns or to surveil people. But at the time, this was new and it got worse.
Online, it got so bad and so out of control.
This is a Libyan activist who was in Benghazi helping organize massive protests during the Arab uprisings. He later went to Canada and got political asylum. He didn't want us to use his name because he fears for his safety. He says Libyan social media was a hotbed of misinformation and hate back then and now.
There is no words to describe how angry I am at Facebook and Twitter. The hate, the racism, the things they allow, the violence.
He says these companies lack the cultural context, the political knowledge, and the language skills to deal with not just Libya, but most content in Arabic. If you think social media is bad in English, he says, you wouldn't believe your eyes in Arabic.
In Arabic, we're not worried about getting canceled. We're worried about getting killed.
This activist told me he despises this idea that the Arab uprisings were fueled by social media. He says that might be a comforting narrative for the West, but it's not true. And it gives white men in Silicon Valley credit for what people like him did.
You didn't give me revolution. Like, you didn't teach me how to protest. I'll give you the credit for the revolution if you take the credit for the civil war.
Because Libya did dissolve into civil war after the Gaddafi regime crumbled. Different factions weaponized social media to vie for power, hunt down opponents, and to stoke division and ethnic hatred. It happened elsewhere, too. People in Myanmar, inspired by the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, tried to use social media to organize. But hate-filled posts and propaganda against the Rohingya, ethnic and religious minority, helped incite a genocide. Facebook has since said it's investing more in people and technology to help curb hate speech in non-English language countries. But the activist from Libya says it's just not enough. As for Wael Ghonim, the activist who started the Facebook page in Egypt, he's come around on this too.
The hardest part for me was seeing the tool that brought us together tearing us apart.
This is from an interview with Frontline Documentaries in 2018. The polarization, the harassment, that all happened in Egypt too.
I was extremely naive in a way I don't like actually now. I don't like admitting that, oh, wow, how naive I was thinking that these are liberating tools.
He said he realized social media platforms enable and even reward bad behavior, sensational and divisive content, and that with so little accountability, these tools are more likely to be used for bad than for good. In that TED talk he gave years after the Arab uprisings, he described how his thinking has evolved this way.
I once said, if you want to liberate a society, all you need is the internet. I was wrong.
Today, he said, I believe that if we want to liberate society, we first need to liberate the internet. For the world, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
If you want to see the Arab uprisings in photos, head on over to theworld.org and also explore our timeline of the major events that helped reshape the region. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Shirin Jafari. You're listening to The World.
Today, we're devoting our entire program to the 10-year anniversary of the start of the Arab uprisings, this day in 2010.
One big reason, Marco, we wanted to take a look back a decade ago is because tens of millions of people are still living through the consequences. As we speak, the war in Syria continues. It might not be as intense as it was a few years ago, but it's still simmering. The fighting in Yemen continues, and more recently, protests have erupted in Iraq, Lebanon, and Algeria.
And as we've seen, with instability comes the displacement of people, one of the most serious outcomes of the Arab uprisings. Unprecedented numbers of people moving across the Mideast, also fleeing to Europe, North America, and Australia.
Back in 2017, I visited a sprawling refugee camp on the border between Syria and Jordan. There were rows upon rows of makeshift tents put up in just a matter of hours so that families could move in. In some parts of the camp, these temporary tents had become permanent.
Right, so much so, Sharon. I remember you reporting that people in these tent cities had started up many small businesses.
That's right. I spoke with a Syrian woman who'd started a beauty salon in the camp. Her name was Shirin, just like mine. She told me I look just like her daughter, who she had to leave behind in Syria in the rush to get out of the country.
Right, so many people try leaving in haste and often with tragic results. Let's turn to someone who can help us understand how dire the refugee situation is today, and just a reminder of how it's evolved since the uprisings began 10 years ago. Shadan Khalaf is a senior policy advisor to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the UNHCR, for the Middle East and North Africa. She joins us from Amman, Jordan. Shadan, give us a picture of where we are at. How many people are still being displaced and from what countries?
So today we have a situation of almost 80 million people who are displaced globally, and 40% of those are located and hosted in the Middle East and North Africa region. So that's a very high proportion, given that this region only makes up between 5 and 6% of the global population in general. And the needs, of course, are quite dire, given the fact that these are countries that have already, even prior to the arrival of these refugees, been struggling with socioeconomic difficulties and, of course, major political shifts over the past 10 years.
And are you still seeing connections among all these millions of people to the first uprisings 10 years ago?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the main reasons for which people had to flee remain in place. The conflicts are unfortunately ongoing, and this is something that we continue to call for, is finding permanent solutions for refugee situations really requires political solutions. The conflicts would need to end for the refugee situations to be resolved. And at the moment, we unfortunately don't see any solutions on the horizon, neither in Syria, nor in Libya, nor in Iraq, the countries where, where we see large numbers of people continuing to be displaced from into the neighboring countries, and where the responsibility on the host communities intensifies year in and year out.
So 10 years on, the migration continues, as you've made clear, Shadan. Do you think organizations like the UNHCR are better prepared now to deal with another mass migration like what we saw in 2014 and 15, if that should happen?
In the past, displacement was largely in camp settings, whereas today the large majority of refugees, beyond the large majority, even almost 85% of the world's refugees, of the region's refugees, are urban, which means that they're living side by side with the nationals of these countries, in urban centers, in residential housing. So the nature of services to them also needs to be different. So we've done a lot of work over the past few years to adapt how we operate and to better be able to reach them through community workers, through NGOs, through other partners, and to strengthen the communication that we have with them also to ensure that we are understanding what they need and how to best serve them. So we've really ramped up a lot of our procedures to adapt to the urban nature of displacement that is also growing globally. And I think this has made us much better prepared for any future such crises.
Yeah, still, the causes for migration are still there. War, conflict, sectarian divides. How much do you feel your concerns as a humanitarian organization are really heard by, say, the governments in Damascus and Cairo that are at the root of a lot of mass migration?
One of our main asks is always that we try to work on ending the conflicts that lead to displacement. And actually, just a couple of days ago, our High Commissioner, Filippo Grandi, made an interesting statement. And he was calling on governments to put us all out of a job, in effect, by eradicating the need for us to exist as a humanitarian organization. So if we resolve the conflicts, there are no refugees, there is no need for us to be doing what we do. And I think that was an interesting way to really highlight the need for political resolution of the conflicts that are leading to displacement.
Shadan Khalaf is a senior policy advisor to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I am Osama Al-Faqih, the Director of Media Communications and Advocacy at Muwatana for Human Rights. I was in Change Square in Sana'a in 2011. I was one of the protesters hoping to build a new Yemen. One of the days in February 2011, I was in Change Square and people there, students, workers, were chanting and singing the national songs with passion, with happiness, dancing and calling for a new Yemen. It was an unforgettable moment for me. On March 18, that day I was in the square. I started hearing shooting. I didn't know what was going on till I get closer, and then I saw people carrying out people who are injured and killed. It was the first time for me to see death in front of my eyes directly.
A state of emergency in Yemen. A desperate attempt by embattled President Ali Abdullah Saleh.
There were around 40 people were killed. Militants were shooting, and that kept for hours.
The decision comes hours.
The central security forces were present, but they didn't intervene. And every time I remember that date, I can remember the smell of blood. The situation today is much, much harder than 2011. Because since the current armed conflict started in September 2014, the violations committed against civilians by all warring parties have been very significant. Now people are looking for security, for protection, for ending to this war. I still consider myself as an activist working in human rights, and I believe that it's still important. It's where I find myself, where I can contribute for causes in my country and for the people of my country.
You're listening to The World. Just a quick reminder from me, Marco Werman, and The World team. Over the past year, The World has brought you reporting on the most pressing issues of 2020 from all corners of the globe. The world is not going anywhere. We are determined more than ever to push through to keep bringing you the expansive global coverage you rely on, no matter what. We've been right there with you all year long. Now we're calling on you to be there for us. We're just 450 people away from reaching our goal of 1,000 donors. When you make a gift of $100, or if you possibly can, $1,000, you'll get to hear your name in our podcast credits. You'll also get an invite to a virtual party with all the incredible people who make this show possible. Help us keep the world accessible to everybody across the globe. Donate today before the year ends. Go to theworld.org/give. And from everybody here at The World, thank you. A decade ago today, the Mideast and North Africa changed forever as people rose up from Tunisia to Yemen. A Libyan-American poet looks back on the resistance and what remains of the dreams of millions of protesters.
The hope still lingers among many people who believed in the need for change.
A decade of tumult today on The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Shirin Jafari.
Today we're looking back at the 10-year anniversary of the Arab uprisings, an earth-shaking chapter that began on this day in 2010 with a desperate act of protest in Tunisia.
The movement quickly spread across the Middle East and North Africa. When the revolution played out in Egypt a decade ago, it seemed like a success story at first. But that was then.
Today, many Egyptians will tell you things are worse than they were before people took to the streets in January 2011. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports on the further erosion of human rights in Egypt.
In the last few months, civil rights activists say Egypt has become a nightmare. In October, the government more than doubled its pace of executions, putting nearly 60 people to death. In November, Egyptian state security arrested three prominent human rights leaders on terrorism charges after they met with Western diplomats. They're with the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, or EIPR.
The EIPR is kind of Egypt's ACLU, or the NAACP. It's that revolutionary, and it's that important.
Rami Yacoub is the founder and executive director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy in Washington. He says it seems like the country is at its lowest point 10 years after such a hopeful moment. A protest movement led by young Egyptians did the unthinkable in February 2011, deposing a military dictator, Hosni Mubarak.
People of Egypt have spoken, their voices have been heard, and Egypt will never be the same.
And I can tell you, like, initially, there was so much freedom of speech, freedom of expression, assembly. I didn't believe it.
But by April 2011, Yacoub remembers thinking that the different revolutionary factions were struggling to work together.
We were successful in creating a political vacuum. The only people that were around to offer a viable option were the Muslim Brotherhood. They were prepared and ready.
The Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi was elected president. That was something the Egyptian military would not let stand. Yacoub says by June 2013, he realized the military was going to win the power struggle.
I remember writing on Twitter multiple times then, like, folks, that's no longer our fight. This is completely out of our hands. Other people are going to take over now, unfortunately.
Morsi was driven out of power by massive protests. Former military chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi took over. He was elected president in 2014. Then, in a series of new laws and executive orders, Sisi solidified his rule. He restricted due process and the freedom of expression. The military used force to end anti-government demonstrations. Human rights groups say political opponents were detained, tortured, and killed. Sisi's government imposed new restrictions on non-governmental organizations and international charities. Many NGOs were forced to close. Stephen McInerney is with the Project on Middle East Democracy, a group that had helped train some activists and protest leaders.
It's been a really steadily escalating campaign of targeting and repression using lots of different tools, using lots of different laws. Of course, there are very difficult circumstances on the ground for anyone who wants to engage politically.
At this point, he says, most democratic activists have fled Egypt. Those remaining have gone underground. McInerney's organization uses encrypted communications to talk to them. Meanwhile, McInerney says, Western countries have done little to support pro-democracy efforts inside Egypt.
And we've been disappointed to see, you know, other democratic countries overlook democratic values in order to profit by selling weapons.
Like the U.S. and, most recently, France. During a visit by Sisi earlier this month, President Emmanuel Macron said France would continue to sell weapons to Egypt despite its human rights record. The Trump administration has made the same decision, allowing military assistance to flow, and Donald Trump has even called Sisi his favorite dictator. At that meeting in France with Macron, Sisi dismissed criticisms about human rights, saying he provides stability. That message still appeals to many Egyptians and to leaders in the West, says Stephen Cook, senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
European leaders have looked the other way when it comes to human rights violations throughout the region, but particularly in Egypt, because they are concerned about instability in North Africa affecting politics in Europe.
Sisi has also defended his actions by saying they're necessary to fight terrorism. Cook says Sisi's reasoning goes something like this.
It's unfair to criticize Egypt because this is human rights as formulated by Egypt's Western critics is really just a form of colonialism.
But Cook says the recent arrests of prominent human rights activists in Egypt set off an unprecedented international outcry. Calling for their release were the UN, the European Union, members of the EU Parliament, also Biden's pick for Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, and celebrities like Scarlett Johansson.
EIPR has for years worked tirelessly and bravely on the front lines. A truly democratic government would celebrate these men, not imprison them.
I think that the Egyptians understood after the outcry that they perhaps had gone too far. But it's very, very hard to tell what's going on.
Earlier this month, the three staffers with the EIPR were abruptly let go. But they still face charges, and thousands of other less famous prisoners remain behind bars. The incoming Biden administration is promising to take human rights in Egypt seriously. That gives Rami Yacoub of the Tahrir Institute some hope.
Sociopolitical change takes time, takes a long time. And as humans, we want prosperity right now. But, you know, 100 years from now, it will be a footnote. But for us humans living through it, it's a long time.
Yacoub says that's the thing about revolutions. Very few of them happen quickly. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
What happened in Egypt continues to inspire pro-democracy activists throughout the region. In Sudan, activists who toppled longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir last year learned from the mistakes in Egypt. For Khartoum resident Dalia Abdel Monaim, it's been a deeply personal journey.
I was living in Cairo, Egypt, when the Egyptian revolution took off. I never thought that in my lifetime I would see such things. People going out and, you know, meeting force and meeting violence, and they had no fear. The Egyptians just went out. And I was at Tahrir Square when Mubarak stepped down, and the euphoria that just was like waves coming to you from the crowd was just amazing. I mean, I'm not Egyptian, but I was screaming like I had just toppled my own president. After seeing the change, I decided it was time that I moved back home, back to Sudan. You know, it was our turn now to do something good for our country. I mean, throughout the 30-year rule of Omar al-Bashir, there was grassroots organization going on, activism going on. It was on the very low level. The ones who were the most directly affected by the rule of Omar al-Bashir were the ones who were the most ardent and the most optimistic about, yes, we can bring about change, we can topple this regime. So they looked, they learned, they studied, they saw what happened in Egypt, they saw what happened in Tunis, in Libya, in Syria, and take that all in, you know, puss it all up together and come up with a formula or a technique that applied to us as Sudanese.
24th year, the Sudanese president is facing what some describe as unprecedented popular dissent.
And we knew that sustainability was the most important factor.
Troops open fire on unarmed demonstrators.
They will break us up, they will beat us, they will attack us, they will harm us.
At least six protesters have been killed in clashes with security forces, medics say.
But we have to keep at it. We can't just give up. We can't just say, okay, we go back home now. So our revolution, it started on December 18th. Before one protest had around 50 people, the next one had 200 and so on and so forth. So after a few months, literally every single city, every single town in the whole country was out protesting against the regime of Omar al-Bashir. For me personally, I never thought that would happen. I thought the fear factor would never be broken, that they had broken our spirit more than anything. But if anything, it proved to me, even whether it's after 30 years of a despot's rule or it's after 10 years, if people want change, if they really believe they deserve change, then that change will come about. It worked. You know, I mean, we will always have that moment when we went out.
The voice and the will of the Sudanese people is being heard with the military.
You know, and it was announced that President Omar al-Bashir had been arrested.
Well, we're seeing a total dissolution of the Omar al-Bashir regime.
You know, I remember calling friends and all we could do was just scream at each other, we did it, we did it, we did it. And also at the same time, we all realize it's not just about having your leader step down and someone replace him. No, you have to have the whole setup removed. You're not going to replace 30 years of authoritarian rule overnight. You know, we've celebrated the small victories, like being removed from the list of countries that sponsor terrorism, the fact that we've been welcomed back into the international arena, political arena. You know, we've taken those small victories, but we know, you know, just one tiny slip and we could go back to where we were. You know, euphoria and optimism can make you very giddy and very idealistic, but reality does bite. And when with that reality, you can see things more logically, more concise, and you can take the proper steps needed to bring about the change or to bring about an effect that you want. We're still a relatively young country, and we're not taking it easy. We're not taking our foot off the pedal, so to speak, and we'll get there. And I really believe we do, because it's not easy now, but it will get better.
When you protest against something, by definition, it means you don't like it. And when you don't like something, it's a natural impulse to make fun of it. During the Arab uprisings, one of the things that moved hundreds of thousands of people to action was satire. In repressive regimes, humor does flourish, but in whispers, person to person. But with the Arab uprisings, it all came into the open. The World's Carol Hills has more.
Bassem Youssef was a big deal during the Arab Spring. He was known as Egypt's John Stewart.
بعد الفاصل هنجاوب على أهم سؤال بيشغل بال المصريين. هي النهضة فين؟
At his peak, a third of the country's population was watching his show. But Youssef came after Egypt's January Revolution in 2011. Well before that, people like Anwar, an Egyptian political cartoonist, were planting the seeds of revolution with their visual satire. Anwar says before 2006, making fun of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was a big taboo. But around that time, as a young man, he found a cartoonist who was pushing that boundary.
I can remember one of these cartoons when he used to draw Hosni Mubarak daily in the newspapers, not from his face, but from the back of his head. And the funny thing is that although he has been drawing him from the back of his head, every reader in Egypt knew that this Hosni Mubarak. So he didn't have even to mention him. He didn't have to show his face. And I think this was one of the cartoons that encouraged me.
So Anwar, young and eager, started doing the same thing. He published his cartoons in an independent Egyptian newspaper. The government there tolerated these cartoons, and Anwar and others kept drawing them. By early 2011, their cartoons were reaching 500,000 readers a day. Anwar, still in his 20s, thought this was what political cartooning was all about. Then, on January 25th, 2011, the Egyptian revolution happened.
We thought that we achieved our dream and we achieved the democratic society. We were even asking ourselves, what are we going to draw in the next days? So we achieved everything. Democracy is here. Now we are having fair elections. The power is now in the hands of the people. What are we going to criticize now?
So I asked Anwar to describe the first cartoon he drew after the revolution.
I still remember this cartoon as one of the silliest cartoons that I have drawn ever. It was a surgeon coming out from the hospital for a group of Egyptian people, and he's holding a baby and telling them that now you have a new country, now you have a new Egypt.
Around this time in early 2011, a satirist in Syria took a similar big step. Ali Frazat was a celebrated political cartoonist who'd been active since the late 1960s. Like in Egypt, directly criticizing the government in Syria was a complete no-no. But in late January 2011, with peaceful demonstrators in Syria being met with force, imprisonment, and torture, Frazat drew a cartoon showing the back of a chair and someone sitting in it but facing away. A woodpecker is pecking away at the leg of the chair. It's going to break. Ali Frazat had had enough.
نحن كنا نرسم الرمز لما كان في داخل سوريا.
Frazat told me he used to draw leaders using symbols like a chair because he was afraid to criticize individuals. But then he crossed the line and started drawing the Syrian leader. And Syrians took notice. His cartoons affirmed what they were feeling, and it emboldened them. Art plays a big role in starting uprisings, Frazat told me, because it's close to the people. It plays the role of an instigator. But as we all know, it's nearly 5 years later, and the Assad regime is still ruling Syria with an iron fist. But Ali Firzat is no longer there to fight the fight. In August 2011, masked gunmen pulled him from a car, beat him, broke his hands, and left him for dead on a road outside Damascus. People nearby came to his aid and got him to a hospital. A few months later, Firzat fled to Kuwait, where he still lives. He now posts his cartoons on Facebook and Instagram, but they are banned in Syria. Still, Firzat has no regrets. He says there are certain things that are critical in life, like freedom, dignity, justice. If you don't rise up for that, then you stand for nothing. For Egyptian cartoonist Anwar, he kept the fight going with his pen in Egypt for 8 years after the revolution. But a combination of repressive politics, social media, and a bad economy have basically decimated independent journalism in Egypt. Now he's drawing his resistance from thousands of miles away. That's because last March, the Egyptian government told him he had 24 hours to leave the country. These days, he publishes his cartoons in the same Egyptian newspaper he always has, but from exile in Berlin. I asked Anwar if it was all worth it.
Right now, I'm far, far away, like thousands of miles from my home. I'm really asking myself this question. Definitely, I would say yes.
Anwar says people like him made history in 2011, and the story is still ongoing. As for Bassem Youssef, he's in exile too, in California. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
I'm Marco Werman. We're marking 10 years since the start of the Arab uprisings today on The World. In Libya, protesters overthrew longtime ruler Muammar Gaddafi, later killed while he was on the run.
Since then, Libya has been in chaos, torn between two rival governments. For a more lyrical view of what happened there in the past 10 years, I spoke with Libyan-American poet and writer Khaled Mutawa, who recalled the first days of the protests in Libya.
In many ways, it was unbelievable because it was the moment that many Libyans had been waiting for after decades of absolute fear. I mean, the pocket that the Gaddafi regime and his military leaders allowed for any kind of freedom of speech was maybe 3-4 years. And then after that, it was absolutely you're either with him or not. It was time for the regime to end, but how and on what basis? So when people started fighting and resisting, there was hope and elation and a sense of affirmation.
Right. And we see that captured in your poems from that time. I would love for you to read one of them that you wrote in 2012. It's called Now That We Have Tasted Hope. Can you read a little bit of that poem for us?
Sure. Now that we have tasted hope. Now that we have come out of hiding, why would we live again in the tombs we'd made out of our souls and the sundered bodies that we've reassembled with prayers and consolations? What would their torn parts be other than flesh? Now that we have tasted hope and dressed each other's wounds with the legends of our oneness, would we not prefer to close our mouths forever shut on the wine that's willed inside them? Listen to me, cities, houses, alleys, courtyards, and streets that throng my veins. Someday soon, in your freed light and in the shade of your proud trees, your excavated heroes will return to their thrones. Lovers will hold each other's hands as if they'd never known fear. Now that we have tasted hope, now that we have lived on this hard-earned crust, we would sooner die than seek any other taste to life.
Khaled, now that you read this poem so many years later, how are you reflecting on the poem?
Well, for many years, I resisted the poem. I felt that I was speaking perhaps about something that failed, that hope failed us. But I read it now and I feel like it captured that moment. I don't think it changed my mind about hope, that hope is very powerful. And in a way, as a friend told me, this poem resonated with them in the time of the epidemic or the pandemic because of the sense of despair they'd felt.
Right. And obviously, we live in a moment where we could use any bit of hope that we can get. So one last question for you, Khaled. We're now 10 years after the start of the Arab uprisings. In some ways, the revolutions are not over. But when you look back, what do you think is the legacy of the so-called Arab Spring?
You are right. The revolutions are not over. Revolutions everywhere, whether it's the American or the French, take decades to germinate and to settle. I think the legacy may be that perhaps there wasn't really a lot of room to decide on some of the questions. In some ways, the Arab Spring took everyone by surprise. The elites were not ready. The revolutions are petering out intellectually or ideologically because some of the urgent questions about governance have not been answered.
Khaled Mottoba is a Libyan-American poet and writer. He's been telling us about the impact of the Arab uprisings in Libya and beyond. Khaled Mottoba, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Shireen. It's an honor to be on your show.
The young people who took to the streets in places like Tripoli and Cairo, they're not young anymore. And with a decade under their belts and revolutions deferred, they've had time to process. Here's one man's story from Tahrir Square in Cairo to his new home in America.
My name is Abdurrahman Ayash. I'm a political researcher and a human rights activist. In 2011, I was 20 years old. I participated in the first wave of demonstrations on January 25th, and I got arrested. I was beaten, I got electrocuted even. But after that, we toppled the regime, so it was totally worth it. So I was in Tahrir Square, actually, when Mubarak stepped down on February 11th. I think this moment was maybe the second best moment of my life. I just got a baby daughter this year and consider this the best moment of my life. But in Tahrir Square, along thousands and thousands of people, I remember laughing and crying at the same time. I was very happy. I was very hopeful at the time. After the revolution, the Muslim Brotherhood was the most powerful in Egypt. And despite their promises that they won't be running for president, they ran. And Morsi won the elections. I didn't vote for Dr. Morsi. But at the same time, I was very, very happy that the regimes didn't win. But in a very short and difficult year, the Muslim Brotherhood were out of their popular support. And this allowed the military to make this bloody military coup. It was July 3rd when the military coup took place. In less than a month, the military and the thugs related to Mubarak's regime started to commit crimes against the Muslim Brotherhood supporters and against many other Egyptians. The worst massacre in the history of Egypt took place. More than 1,000 people died in one day, and I personally lost many friends. Right now, I live in the U.S., and now I cannot say that I have a single friend who's politicized and still live in Egypt. They are either in exile or they are in jail, or unfortunately, they are dead. I think what we did in 2011 was the most noble thing that I personally ever did. We enjoyed a couple years of freedom that we've never experienced before, and now I know how it feels to be free. I know that this is what I want for my daughter. And yes, I believe that we'll be able to bring this freedom back to Egypt. Not today, maybe not next year, but I'm sure that we are on the right way to bring it back.
A note of optimism there, and that is our show on this, the 17th day of December, 10 years since the start of the Arab uprisings, still living today with their legacy. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRX.